someone's not here, don't write something in there. In the space after their name. Don't give me a little nasty black on dishes. Because the reason I have this method is for speed. It's a large class. I don't need to do it. So I just glance down through it and then just record the absence. I'll record you present with them, your big part. I'll record the absence. They're simplified these plans down here by seeing a blank space. Record it, take your 25 seconds. Record your attendance every day. But if I have to read everyone to see if if the spaces are not blank, and you have a person in the present because somebody's put a little message in there, it slows you down considerably. An exceeding dim view if I find something written in one of these spaces when the person is absent. Indication how dim of you I'm going to take of it. I see more of them than are everybody after for that day. I'm going to do all the time, but I read all of them. I'm just going to go a while. Anyway, understand? But don't write in the spaces. Secondly, let me remind you, some of you are initiates in the Pharisees and Salazar. They were, because they were isolationists, they were not in the mainstream of Jewish life, the same as the Pharisees and Sadducees were. And that way they were not, they are important in that. Their writings, the Dead Sea Scrolls, have survived and have been found. And they come from a period where there's very little other primary information, very little original historical data. That makes them important historically from our point of view. Got that? Because they loom larger in our looking back than they did in their own day. What we found, because there's a dead period as far as, for instance, we have infinitely more documentary evidence, literary evidence, writings, from the period of 1500 B.C. to 1000 B.C., 400 B.C. to present time. It's much earlier, we've got much more material. Understand? So because they were found, and because the liberal German-oriented critics had said, if we could find anything from the Essenes, we would see that Jesus and John the Baptist got their ideas from the Essenes. So as soon as the scrolls, and they really believed this, by the way, so as soon as the scrolls were found, they said, aha, now we have it. They began to study them and found it didn't work out. Okay. Any other questions, Ben? Did I answer your question, Ben?
Yeah.
Any other questions? Today we're going to finish the discussion of the Jewish sects, whether we don't say or not. Let me just remind you what I said about the Pharisees. We talked about the Pharisees already because we talked about the development of the Hasidic tradition. What is the Hasidic tradition? What am I talking about here? When did it develop? Under what circumstances?
It's about time when you're going to play us.
Okay, but there's a power that developed as an opposition to Hellenism, the 2nd century B.C. The attempt to make Jerusalem and Palestine Hellenistic. The Hasidic line, the Hasidim, call people back to the law, and out of the Hasidic tradition developed the Pharisees. Their emphasis on the law, and they hated out the law. You have the Hasidic Pharisaic tradition, which resulted in ultimately the collection of writings of the Talmud, but that's much later. Talmud constitutes the heads about the law. The Pharisees were those who were in this line in the first century. The Hasidim came before the first century. The Talmud, of course, was written for much later. But the Pharisees were those who were resisting paganism, idolatry. They said you couldn't even carry a coin into the temple. It had Caesar's image on it. extreme observance of the law, washing of hands, diet, tithing of the vegetables from the garden, this is all reflected in the New Testament. Now, the Pharisees, however, one thing we need to say is the Pharisees, compared to the Sadducees, for instance, were the popular party. That is, they were among the people, they were supported by the people. The Sadducees were an aristocratic minority. We'll talk about them in a minute. The Pharisees, you get the impression in the New Testament that everybody hated the Pharisees. Call somebody a Pharisee, as I've said, you call him a bad name. How are there many good Pharisees? Paul's a Pharisee. And he said, I was acting honorably, I thought we got the service. Jesus said to one Pharisee, you're not far from the kingdom. The Pharisees were not always the bad guys. And the fact that they tried to make Jesus observe, you know, keep away from the edge, did not cause Jesus to create an adversary situation, an antagonism between Jesus and the Pharisees. However, we must not assume this. The Pharisees were generally hated. They were not. They were with the people. They were more popular. They had this. They were the popular party, as I said. Compared to Sadducees, everybody loved them, but they were friends. They were the leaders. They were the leaders in the synagogue. They were the recognized leaders of popular Judaism. Okay, now, the Sadducees, in contrast, and by the way, not much is known about the beginning of the Sadducees. They appear in the first century, in the writings of Josephus and the New Testament, as an aristocratic minority whose primary activities centered about what? The temple. And as a result of this, when the temple was destroyed in AD 70, that was the end of the Sadducees. Whereas the Pharisees, whose the center of their thinking was not the temple as such, but the law, when the temple was destroyed, they became, they continued as the leaders of popular Judaism, both in the Pharisaic tradition. Now, popular Palestinian Judaism, not necessarily Hellenistic Judaism. Okay, now the Sadducees had as their, and by the way, I'm just going to cover this because in your reading in Bruce, he covers this. The Sadducees are known because, we've already said, they were the temple crowd. They were the temple keepers. They were an aristocratic minority. What does aristocratic mean?
Yeah, elite.
Elite, wealthy, of the best families. They were generally hated by the people. They were not respected by the people, not as much as the Pharisees. The Sadducees, theologically, the second major, or one of the major aspects, or the major aspect of the theology was this, that they rejected the prophets. They rejected the developments in Jewish thinking which came from the prophets. That is, they held to the Torah only. They're sort of an offshoot of the Hasidic tradition. But they, whereas the Pharisees would honor the prophets, you know, Jesus said, You whitewash the tombs of the prophets, you honor them. But if you say if we had been alive back then, we would not have persecuted the prophets the same way our fathers did. Jesus, that is the truth. You're the children of those who stoned the prophets. But at least the Pharisees gave lip service to the prophets, and they honored, in other words, they would honor the teachings of Isaiah and Jeremiah, and they were familiar with them. Jesus quoted Daniel the prophet. And Jesus quoted Isaiah, the prophet of the synagogue, and the people accepted this and loved this. Not so the Sadducees. The Sadducees rejected the development in Jewish thinking which came to the prophets. They had no patience with the prophets. They said the only will of God is found, and the word of God is found in the law, the Torah, the earlier aspects of canonical writings. Okay?
It's the Torah, like Genesis, correct?
The Pentateuch is the Torah of the law.
Alright,
well,
there was
a prophecy in there, too. Yes, they rejected the prophets as a... they rejected anything later than the Torah.
How did they believe in the Messiah? That's why they didn't believe in the resurrection, right?
Yes. For instance, many of the concepts, such as the concept of the resurrection, they rejected the idea of the resurrection from the dead. And the idea of the resurrection of the dead is not explicit in the Torah. It's implicit. Abraham was dead to his fathers, you know, but it's not explicit. It's not very explicit in the prophets, to say the truth. Some places it is. Some of the Psalms it is. But, Steve, you had a question that I didn't want to ask him. They rejected. They accepted the Torah, but nothing else.
What about
Torah? Now they didn't necessarily. They wouldn't say necessarily. It's not the word of God, but they just simply didn't have any time for it. They didn't believe in it. Many of the aspects of Judaism came into the Talmud, the age of the Talmud. The tabernacle worship, or temple worship, was part of the Torah.
If they didn't believe in the resurrection, it's hard for me to think of what their value was for believing in God at all. I mean, what profit, what difference would it make?
Whether
or not.
Well, you're looking from your point of view. We find it hard to understand anybody who didn't believe in life after death could have not believed in anything much at all, because we believe in it. Good question, though. Any other questions? Did not believe in the resurrection, but did not believe in angels. Which is strange, because do you find angels mentioned in the Torah? Yes. But they didn't believe in angels, and they didn't believe in. Now it's interesting, and so Jesus, when Jesus argues for the resurrection from the dead, interestingly enough, he argues from the Torah. What is Jesus' proof of the resurrection from the dead? Jesus says, I'll show you from the scripture, from the Torah, resurrection from the dead. What does he say? Oh, come on. What did Jesus say? He said, God said, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Who did he say that to? Moses. And when he said that, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were dead. Weren't they? And you read, Jesus said, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. He said, I was the God. I am the God. God is not the God of the dead or the living. That's an interesting argument, isn't it? If Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob no longer exist, then how could God in the days of Moses be the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? That's a logical argument. God said, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I've never thought of that. but Jesus, I think, used that argument because they glorified, he's using the section of scripture that they accepted. But again, see, the concept of life after death is not, of course, nearly as clear in the Old Testament as it is in the New Testament. In fact, the main scholars, some conservative scholars, I heard a professor from the West Coast in the Bible College, put up a piece, the idea of life after death is not in the Old Testament. Not true. It's not, if it is, not, if it is true, it's not as clear as it is in the New Testament. Okay. Now the Sadducees, of course, appear in the New Testament as very antagonistic to Jesus, because Jesus agreed with the Pharisees in teaching life after death, or the resurrection of the dead. Now, I want to mention briefly the Zealots, and we all know who they are. They were the political revolutionaries. They were the ones who called the false messiahs before the time of Jesus, and the ones after the time of Jesus, they were those who saw themselves as the children of Judas Maccabeus, his tradition, to take a sword, take up arms, overthrow Rome. and they, we know, we're committed to the fact that you can study this in the life of Christ, how the zealots tried to make Jesus a revolutionary leader and refused. The last group that we're going to talk about, and that and talk about them today, is the Samaritans. Now, they are a sect of the Jews. I include them here. I list them in the outline as a section of themselves, not a sect of the Jews. You can consider them both ways. It depends on how you look at it. You say this. What I'm saying is, if you ask the Samaritans, are they a sect of the Jews? Sometimes they'd say yes, sometimes they'd say no. If you ask the Jews, they'd say no, they're not. If you ask the historian, they'd say yes, they are. What were they? Well, they were over everything and not much of anything. Josephus, who hated the Samaritans, and the Jews, as the Jews didn't hate the Samaritans, he pointed out that whenever things were going well for the Jews, the Samaritans would claim to be Jewish. When anybody came in to give the, when the Romans, for instance, came in to give the Jews the business, the Samaritans said, oh, we're not Jews. And he hated them for that. Fair weather friends. And were the Samaritans Jewish? Well, yes and no. The Samaritans are pre-rabbinic. That is, they go back before the Hasidic tradition. You find beginnings of the Samaritans in the Old Testament. At what period? When you're reading, what period? Where do you find, where are the Samaritans? Say, back to
Back to 722.
Oh, that's right. The very following 722. It's right, Scott. It's when the Assyrians conquered the northern kingdom. Samaria was the capital of the northern kingdom. The Samaritans, when the Assyrians under Sennacherib took out Hadadezer and his outfit, they the Assyrians had conquered northern, and now in Jesus' time the whole area was called Samaria as well as the city of Samaria, but Samaria was the capital of the northern kingdom, which they had, Jezebel's capital. When the Assyrians conquered it, they exported several thousand of the nobility and brought in peoples, and the Jews who were there intermarried with the pagans that were brought in. Most of them were also, there was not a racial integration as such, it was religious, they were for the most part Semitic peoples. All of them, most of them. And so when after the fall of Jerusalem in 586, after the fall of Babylon in 538, and when Cyrus the Persian took over and allowed the Jews to come back at the close of the Old Testament period, when Ezra and when Nehemiah and Zerubbabel came back, they ran into the Samaritans, who said, let us help you build. They said, no, why not? They said, let us in on this. We're Jewish. And they said, no, you are not. You see, they had mixed not only their blood, they had mixed their faith with the pagan peoples. So what they believed was a mixture of Judaism and paganism. It's interesting. They, like the Sadducees, accepted Moses. And there's a Samaritan Pentateuch which goes back older, which is older than any manuscript tradition that we have. Our Old Testament is of the Masoretic manuscript tradition. It goes back to the period somewhat before the 2nd century B.C. And this is reflected in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Remember I said the Dead Sea Scrolls doctrines, the scriptures, the Old Testament found the Dead Sea Scrolls are the same tradition, scriptural tradition of the Masoretic tradition as what we use. However, the Samaritan Pentateuch goes back before that. Very ancient. Back to the period of the Samaritans. 350, 375, 400 B.C. The Samaritans used the Old Testament, used the Pentateuch, the Torah, but not much else. There was nothing else. They were like the Sadducees in that. But, as I say, there, and not too much is known about them. Their religion was a mixture of Judaism, of the law of Moses, and paganism. Let's say, were they Jews? Well, yes and no. Depending on who's saying, who's identifying. And depending on, let's say, if the Jews were having good days and they put there were Jews, not. That's why the Jews hated them. And they hated the Jews. There's a lover's quarrel, and there were the people who are close hate each other always. You have to be really close to somebody to hate them. That's why most people are murdered and murdered by somebody they're married to. or were married to. You see, for every person who's murdered in Raider Orlando by the enemy, you find 30 or 20 people murdered by a friend. You watch your friend, you're going to take a question about that.
What's the date? What date did you decide?
On what?
For when the murder first heard.
I didn't give a date. You can't give a date. It goes back to the end of the Old Testament period. Jim, you want a date? 700 BC. Take that home, put it up on your wall. I'll give it to myself. You gotta say, you can't really say. After the fall of Samaria, began this process which resulted in a people called Samaria. You see, I say 700 going to count backwards, you know, you see, you know that. Okay. Now, where do we run into the Samaritans in the New Testament? Well, who's the most famous Samaritan of all? The Good Samaritan. And, of course, the woman at the well was more important. So we've got to make a decision on this. This calls for an academic. Now for my academic training at the university is going to pay off. Good Samaritan. The most famous story in the New Testament is the story of the Good Samaritan. It's not a parable. Call that. It's not a parable as such. And it's made more important because the man who helps the Jew becomes the neighbor was a Samaritan. And John, who tells about the encounter of the Samaritan woman at the well, the encounter between she and Jesus, explains. John adds this editorial comment so that the readers will understand, that the Gentile readers, those who didn't live around Palestine, understand. So the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. He adds that comment there John chapter 4. John chapter 4. Because the woman has said to Jesus, well, how is it you're speaking to me being a woman, number one, being a Samaritan, number two? Now, she, of course, we all know this, she asked Jesus the question. Well, the Jews say that we worship God down in Jerusalem, and we say here on this mountain, which was Mount what?
Here.
So at that time, there was a temple there. And Jesus said, well, as a matter of fact, the Jews are right. Salvation is of the Jews. You got the wrong place. However, the day's coming. With what? Neither on this mountain, nor in Jerusalem. Interesting comment. The Jerusalem is not going to be the center of worship anymore. Anyway, it's going to be that way anymore. But God, we're going to worship God in spirit. And it's going to be something better, he explains. Now, the Samaritans are very interesting, are very important, because they were significant peoples. The Samaritans, for instance, when the Romans had a policy of recruiting nationals for their army. They found that people would put up with a Roman army if the troops were not Romans, better than the troops were Romans. Now, the officers would be Roman, but often the troops would be mercenaries. The Greeks, many detachments of the Roman army, many of the legions were made up of Greeks. The Greeks liked to fight. They had a long tradition of mercenary wars. And the Greeks fought for many years, back in the 5th century and the 4th century BC, the Marathon, the Battle of Thermopylae, Salamis, and then the wars, for instance, the late 9th century, Xenophon. See, the Xenophon, he wrote about the famous Anabasis, which is often translated the march up country. He was with a group of Persia. He was with a group of Greek mercenaries. They're not fighting for Greece. They were being in the pay of the Persians. And the Greeks developed a developed a long military tradition. They became professional soldiers. Because understand the ancient world, there was nothing of this loyalty to the country nearly as much as loyalty to a general. Now, the Jews, the only two countries that actually were national, in the sense that we understand that term today, were the Jews and Egypt, by the way. Egypt is the exception to almost everything. They would fight for the country, and the Jews would fight for their country. Most of the Romans, they would fight for their general. The Romans, you see, the Romans fought just as many wars against other Romans as they did against non-Romans. And the Greeks fought more wars against other Greeks than they did against non-Greeks. The great Peloponnesian War was, the Greeks, like the Arabs, they could never... The big thing Alexander the Great did was get the Greeks to quit fighting each other. But as I said before, he had to conquer Greece before he could conquer the rest of the world. So there was a long Greek tradition of mercenaries. And so the soldiers in the Roman army, and they could never, the Romans could never get the Jews, at least not very many of them, to serve in the Roman army. We're not going to march under the eagle, this was idolatry. Image and other reasons too. They might die, and they were just the Romans. The Jews made good soldiers if they under right circumstances. But if they didn't want to be in the army, they were terrible soldiers, and they had more trouble than they were. So they gave up on it. And so the majority of the soldiers in the Roman army, not the officers now, but the rank and file soldiers in Palestine in the days of Jesus were Greek and Samaritan. The Samaritans were there. Now the Samaritans, have survived. For this very important, and I would have you note this, that except for the Samaritans, all forms of Mosaic animal sacrifice, the Ark of the stopped with the destruction of the temple in 87. The Samaritans, however, continued their animal sacrifice on Mount Gerizim. And by the way, they are still doing it today. The only peoples in the world who practice animal sacrifice. Now,
by modern Palestine, they were a minority who married within their own group, but who have continually.
Over the generations, they have their numbers have shrunk. Their group got so small that they're beginning to move out to marry outside. The Samaritans are probably another generation will be gone completely as a distinctive group. They're being as the group keeps getting smaller and smaller. They run into problems caused by consanguinity. What at least is consanguinity? Consanguinity is why you cannot marry in most states your first cousin. Consanguineous marriages are marriages of consanguinity means of the same blood. Of the same blood. And a consanguineous marriage is a marriage that's illegal because you're too close to related to the person. And so consanguinity, this marriage within the same blood, has created a lot of problems. I have a funeral up in Appalachia, and we buried this person we buried this person up in on the hill. We all grabbed the coffin and took off up the creek bed and spilled one another off and walked up the mountain. We buried him, and the relatives came out of the hills, and some of them were
slick skinned, glassy eyed, and indulged, so they were mentally retarded because of consanguinity. They married first cousins, double first cousins, and for so many years that they could become defective. And you all know that, don't you? You understand that principle. This is not new to you. Same thing's true in animals. Because they had that. In the state of Indiana several years ago, everybody got worried that the quail population was going to be getting too small. The conservationists got in really said we're going to be tired of 5-year moratorium on quail hunting, or 3-year anyway, long quail hunting period. And all the old hunters said that'll be the end of the quails. And that's what it means. You wait and see. So sure enough, with no hunting permitted, the quails were not forced to move. They would stay in their own covey for 3 or 4 generations, and the birds they would breed within their own group, and get smaller and smaller, and fewer and fewer. This about died out. Finally, the only thing that saved them was somebody woke up and got them to hunt them again. And the hunter would break up the coveys, force them to move. They would breed with other coveys of quail, and they're back strong as ever now. Anyway, so the Samaritans faced this. They allowed no marriage outside of their group. Some way the way they survived. But now there are so few that so many of their children are becoming defective that they are permitting marriage outside the group. Same thing, by the way, some of the Anabaptist groups, like the Quakers in certain areas, and some of these kind of groups, Mennonite groups, they learned that lesson themselves. Especially in Minnesota, up in Dakota, some of these areas, they would go in and marry within, they have maybe 300 or 400 or 500 people, and over 6 or 8 generations, they would marry within their own group, and so having a high percentage of their children defective, so they quit it. So Samaritans face the same thing. But there are today about 500, that's a very recent count. They centered in the recent modern times in Holon. On the map here, and Nablus, which is the site of ancient Shechem, Nablus and Holon. Holon down toward the coast. There are two divinities, Nablus and Holon. Holon down this way, and then after the 1948 repartitioning of that area, they all moved to Holon, most of them did, down the coast, and that's where they are today. Holon, H-O-L-O-N. That should be on here. Oh yeah, I'm looking at it, you can't see it. Well, that doesn't make it not that important. The point is that they, and if you look at go to Israel today, and at certain times you can see them sacrificing animals. Interesting, their way of life. The historian would say their culture petrified. Their culture petrified, and they live basically the way they did back in the age of Jesus. It's never changed. And here is a passage around. I'll just show you. These pictures aren't very good anyway. These are off the machine. It shows two Samaritan priests slaughtering a lamb. You see that well enough? It's not that important. I guess it's not a good picture. They're slaughtering a lamb. This is animal sacrifice. No, sorry. Yeah. That's the lamb. That's a man. it shows them, that's what all the pictures have, it shows them, interestingly enough, in their white robes. They go to Mount Gerizim and they dress in white ceremonial robes, which may reflect the fact that the ancients Jesus said, look at the field, they're white in the harvest. And when he said that, the Samaritans were coming out, possibly, from the city that the Samaritan woman had called. Some commentators think that the Samaritan, the distinctive white robes of the Samaritans created from the background for that statement of Jesus. But the fields are white, these people coming out in their white garments. And he says that if they're white in the heart, it's kind of play on words. Possible, you can't be sure about that, but they do wear white ceremonial robes today. Any questions on the Samaritans? Hold on. That's right, yeah. It's not the Tel Aviv, but on this map, that's what you find today. They were forced to move out of this area because of the war. Yes.
Were there many of them during the time of Jesus?
Yes, we don't know how many, but there were a lot. They were just like one of another conquered people. They regarded as a second Jews. Plus, they're a second Jew thing of who you're asking and when you're asking them. They were Jewish in many ways. We don't know anything about them. We do know that there are many pagan elements in their worship, and yet they accept the Torah, they accept the God of Israel, accept that Abraham is their father. Beyond that, we don't know a whole lot about what they held back today. It's sort of a big brain that we did, but I'm not one definition yet.
What was the reason for it? During the time of Jesus, that the Jews did not pass through Samaria, is that because of uncleanness?
Why they would not generally go through Samaria, why would they would take their Jordan Valley route? Well, a couple of reasons. They hated the Samaritans, although it was not unsafe to travel. Jesus wasn't in danger of his life when he was traveling through the country of the Samaritans. It wasn't bad. You might not find a place to sleep. You're caught overnight. Nobody let you in. But that was part of the reason. But the main reason was that it was a mountain road. You see from the topographical indications on this map and the coloring, it was right down the spine of these mountains, this mountain range. It was shorter, but it was rougher. Often depending on the time of the year. Now, if you were going in the dead of summer, you might want to because it was cooler. But the normal route was to go down through Jericho, cross over, and go up this way, up this road, because it was flat and there was lots of water, and in the wintertime it'd be warmer. I'm sorry, Anyway, it was very humid. I mean, but not too warmer. We go up this way and cross over right here, that following valley. The ancients. First, he says in the New Testament, he's probably our cousin of another class. Jesus went down from Jerusalem to Samaria. John went down. That was down, literally. We think up north and down south. It's interesting. We don't think in terms of elevation today because of automobiles. In fact, do you ever have a route that you've driven several times and then ride a bicycle on it and realize there's a hill there? You didn't even know it was there. You realize there's a hill, start walking it. If you walked everywhere you went, you would know where every hill was. And it's very rough to travel on a mountain road. You see, and the hard thing about mountainous terrain, the hard part, by the way, about traveling on a mountain road is not climbing. The hard part is not going up, the hard part is coming down. Ask anybody to travel on a mountain that much hiking, you're much better off going up than you are coming down. Nothing will kill your feet and if you're back or people walking down, if you walk down backwards, torture, and if you walk down. And then my brother-in-law and I used to, or later through the summer, we'd hike into the backcountry of British Columbia. We'd fish in some of these wilderness lakes, and there were these mountains logging roads, and we'd walk about 5 miles of this logging road, and come through the woods, come back the next day, hike out. Once you're in, the nightfall, you're in there, you can't get out. And so, the next day we'd be tired anyway, you stay up all night and make coffee and light eat. I used to hate it. The next day, come out, walk back, because you were walking down. That's the real rough part of walking on that road, walking down.
So, next week, I present with,
No, they were all mixed up. They couldn't. Okay. one of the reasons Jews hated them. Of course, my brother's Jewish, but we couldn't trace where it is either. Just thought they could. Yeah.
The scribes were not a sect.
Well, I say yes, and depending on who you define them. Depending on how you define them. I would say yes, but I consider them separately because they're generally a separate study.
I mean the scribes, not the...
Oh, I'm sorry, the scribes. No, the scribes were not a separate set, a sect. They were a part... Most of the scribes were Sadducees. They were sort of a group within. So, but not all of them. Some were Pharisees, but they were not a sect separately. They were teachers.
Sanhedrin
was made. The Sanhedrin was made up of of Pharisees. Jews appear, and they see when you had during the intertestamental period various communities of Jews, which centered around cities, around towns. The basic political unit was not the state. The basic political unit was the town. You tend to have, and so what you have, this was called Galilee. The majority of people, probably. The historians are arguing about this, but probably the majority of the people in Galilee were not Jews at all, they were Gentiles. But there were certain Jewish communities, Bethsaida, Chorazin, Capernaum. Tiberias was the main town right here, was Gentile. So he doesn't go in Tiberias. He stays in the Jewish community, following his policies of being sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So it was all under Herod. There is an omission on the outline that I gave you. I just realized it. There we go. I have the Herodian succession as next. And it, there should be a study. Roman numeral, it should be the Caesars between those. This is right, don't bother getting the Roman numeral, worry about this. I'm telling you this because I'm not getting to the Herodian succession next because I intend to study the Caesars at this point. I forgot to do this. I'm mistaken. Run the outline and then finish it. Okay? So we'll get to the Herodian succession next. I have given you. Should have one, a copy of the second, a sort of chronological survey outline of the Second Commonwealth chronology. Now, this will help you. I will make constant reference to this for you. It gives you the timeline, shows you who's ruling in Rome, who's in Judea, the procurators, and the areas of direct interest of Christianity. Those four columns. So, that's okay. Everybody get one? Hey, why are they? They're still, some of the fellows came in late, we broke up their meeting. You certainly get one of these. And you'll in the left, of course, I have the line of the Caesar. Now I'm going to discuss really just through Nero in detail because this takes us to the New Testament period, and that's our assignment in this class, the rule of the New Testament. Now, after the death of Augustus, you see, he ruled from 27 B.C. to A.D. 14. This is during the youth of Jesus. In A.D. 14. Tiberius
came to the throne. And this takes us up through the beginnings of the ministry of John the Baptist and Jesus' public ministry, roughly. Okay? So, during Jesus developed late teenage years, in his late teenage years, roughly from the time, some of the hatred of the zealots for Rome, some of the disrespect. Help us understand why people would, when the gospel is preached, many people would be thoroughly disenchanted with Rome. Now, what we're kind of preparing, what we're going to see as we pursue, I'm going to be sharing with you concerning Tiberius today. What we're going to see is that Augustus set himself up, as Julius Caesar had done, set himself up as the de facto emperor, dictator of Rome, with an idea, I think, historians agree upon, I think they're right, that of really making Rome great. And Augustus, in his own context, from his own viewpoint, was a great man, a great emperor. We would disagree with many things, but as we've already seen, he did put the empire in order, didn't he? He, in many ways, and as I indicated on one of my test questions, that the Augustan reform helped the church much more than it hurt the church. But you see, the problem with the dictatorship is this. Many people believe that democracy is the best form of government upon earth. That's of course not true. Democracy is the best form of government if you got two conditions. Number one, if you don't have a perfect emperor, because the ideal form of government is a kingdom, an emperor, if he's the right man. You got a man who's perfectly good, perfectly fair, perfectly wise, then you'll let him run things. But under the circumstances, since we don't have anybody like that, you follow me? Under the circumstances, democracy is a better form of government, because what it does is spread the evil thinner. And the democracy, I interrupted myself, democracy is the best form of government. Number one, if you don't have a perfect emperor. Number two, if you have a wise electorate. The old principle that a man's vote is no better than his mind. He's a wicked, corrupt, self-serving man, that his vote will be a wicked, corrupt, self-serving vote. The democracy becomes a very bad form of government. It's a tyranny of the proletariat. Yes? Emperor. Why? Electorate.
Electorate.
I'm sorry. That means those who vote. Okay? Now, and so I said that so I could talk about the problem that Rome had now was that they had ceased to be a republic. They were now an empire with an emperor. And it worked pretty well under Augustus. But after the death of Augustus, the Roman Empire fell heir to all the ills that can fall heir, that have come to a kingdom that has a lousy king. It is a great tribute to the strength of the Roman Republic and the Roman Empire that it lasted so long, that it survived so many. The Roman, you see, this way, you take a few steps back and look at the Roman world. Here's what you see, that Rome, or the Roman government, or the Roman Empire, which grew out of the Roman Republic, was basically a very solid political system. It was corrupt, that's true. It was inconsistent, that's true. It was all kinds of bad things. But basically, the system of government was sound. It was a very good machine that, once it got in motion, tended to keep in motion. Therefore, it was able to survive for a long time very bad leadership. I think, by the way, you see the same thing in America. The American system of government, which has been decentralized traditionally, they have strong state governments, state courts, local courts, county, city courts, city administration, it's a very cumbersome, complicated, elaborate system of government which involves many people. But one of the values of it is, it's pretty hard to turn over. Therefore, the American government, for instance, the American system, as we know it, the American government, can withstand a lot of corruption. There can be a lot of corruption in high places, and yet the thing still plugs along under its own steam. And that's what you see with Rome. Now, as opposed to some very fragile political systems, for instance, I admit that the smaller Central and South American countries, we have a very fragile political system, and every few weeks they overthrow the emperor, and the whole thing falls apart. For instance, America could go through a terrible experience of the Nixon years. I'm not judging one way or the other, I'm just saying that any time a president is accused of what he's accused of, and he has to resign, and this whole thing, many countries, a lot of people don't realize this, in most countries haven't been ended that form of government. They've been replaced by a new government. But basically, our government never batted an eye. That as far as the normal economy, there was a trains ran, the mail moved, the money maintained, the inflation rate didn't, in other words, the money didn't become valueless. See, the army didn't have to take over the capital. You know, everybody got up and went to work and, you know, through the whole thing because the system was so different. You see that? Taking time, because time to explain this, because if I don't, you might get the impression, well, certainly what we're going to study with Tiberius and Caligula and some of their outfit, sure, the whole system would fall apart. And the answer is, it didn't. Rome eventually, now see, that was our system of government, or any good system of government. Rome was a very good system of government as far as making things work. It can stand a lot of corruption, but only so much. And Rome eventually did crumble. But it took a long time. You all understand that, what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I say that because the first time I read this, I thought, oh man, that'd be the end of Rome, some of these characters pull. But it wasn't. Rome was a cumbersome, comparatively efficient, workable. So the Romans knew how to run things. They knew how to administer. Now, as opposed to, by the way, remember what I said about Alexander the Great? When he died, that was the end of the Greek Empire. You know what? The whole thing crumbled. Because he did not set up an international form of government. He did not establish a bureaucracy, you call it. Okay. Now, and if I didn't interrupt myself too much, let me continue saying what I was saying a few moments ago, and that is that that Augustus set up this good form of government, but the men who came along after Augustus, for the most part, were not as good as he was. In the second century, you find some pretty good ones. Marcus Aurelius was pretty good from a Roman viewpoint, and some others. But these men did not do as good a job as Augustus. And the promise, now, help us understand why so many Romans became Christians. Why, by the end of the first century, being a Roman was almost synonymous with being a Christian. Why? Because the Roman people in the first century had been promised by Augustus. They had been promised by Virgil in the Aeneid. What did he promise? The golden age. This messianic child in the fourth eclogue we read. Going to usher in a messianic age. And for a while it looked like this promise was going to be kept. Because Augustus did make things work very well. But then, with the kind of leadership they had in Rome following Augustus, the Roman people became disillusioned. That Rome really surely was not the city of God. And the Roman Empire was not really the kingdom of heaven. And the rule of Caesar was not the rule of the gods. He was not Lord. He was not. Why would so many, many Romans laugh at the idea that Caesar was Lord? And when Paul preached it, when so many Romans accepted it back in the days of Augustus. We're going to see much of the reason, part of the reason, not all the reason, part of the reason in the personalities of the men who ruled Rome after Augustus, during the days of the beginnings of the church. And I'm wondering what was going on in Rome. Why would so many people, when the gospel promised a real hope, why were there so many people who were so thoroughly disillusioned with the promise of the Augustan age? Peace on earth and justice. Prosperity. You see in some of these men. Now, with that introduction, which is extra long, let's come to Tiberius. Now, I'm going to do most of my lecturing, by the way, from the primary source. You don't mind me, do you? The excerpt. You want to read, this is Suetonius. Now, as I've said before, Suetonius is the primary source for the Julio-Claudian emperors, that is, this line of emperors. Let me remind you that Suetonius, you cannot, that Suetonius is generally reliable, however, it's everybody knows, all historians know, that Suetonius didn't like these Caesars. That is, there was probably many good things about them that he didn't tell. He cast them in the worst possible light. Not that he lies, but Suetonius contains a lot of, he repeats a lot of gossip. So with that disclaimer, that with that qualification, we get a basic picture, but you understand, here's a man who didn't like these men. This is Suetonius. Suetonius. Now, he writes about Tiberius, and I'm just going to excerpting. This is a modern translation of Tiberius. He establishes that Tiberius was of the Claudian line. The Claudian line was the line that was established by Julius Caesar, the Julio-Claudian emperors. And you see, now listen to me, according to Roman theory, senatorial rank, high office, was hereditary. Now, the way it worked out, that rule was passed from one, by this time we can talk about an emperor now, to another, was through, there was to be a son. However, these men that didn't have sons, Augustus didn't have a son, or they didn't like the ones they had, and what they would do is they would adopt, just about anybody wanted to adopt. For instance, Augustus was the grandnephew of Julius Caesar, but he'd been adopted as a son. Adoption was very commonly done. By the way, I wish I had time to talk about that, how this bears upon understanding the New Testament concept. We would see the adoption of sons. Often a man would adopt his own child. See the working letter? He doesn't think of being a child. The ancients had a concept. You were the child of whoever you were like. And that was almost as important as being a child of the flesh.
Did you say Augustus started with some quality line?
Yes. Yes. It's called the Julio-Claudian line because it includes Julius Caesar. It said Augustus was in the same family. It's called the Julio-Claudian line.
It was Augustus that actually started.
Yes. Don't worry about this. I'm not going to ask this on a test. This was a course of the Roman Empire, which is not that important. Now, he's talking about what he's doing in the early part of his, he's talking about Tiberius. He's establishing the fact that Tiberius is a Claudian. He's of the Claudian family. And so he writes this. Writes about one of his ancestors. Note this, he's saying, well now Tiberius was a real bad actor. But that's the kind of family he came from. One of his ancestors, who was called Claudius the Fair, is Claudius the ancestor of Tiberius, who as a consul took the auspices before a naval battle off Sicily. What they would do is they'd take chickens with them on the boat, and they would use these chickens in various ways to foretell their fortunes, whether it was a good day for battle or not. And one of these was that the chickens would eat. That was a good sign. And the chickens wouldn't eat. That was a bad sign. You weren't supposed to go into battle. Claudius at the office of that day, they called him the chicken. Before a naval battle off Sicily, 2 years before now. Before a naval battle off Sicily, finding that the sacred chickens had refused their feed, cried, if they will not eat, let them drink. And threw them overboard. And he went into battle anyway. Because that was a bad sign. Chickens wouldn't eat. So they said, the priest said, the chickens won't eat. We shouldn't go into battle. Won't eat, let them drink. Threw them overboard, went into battle, and was soundly defeated, and wiped out. So Suetonius said, that's the kind of answer that Tiberius had.
That's where they got
some
chicken
and
mouse.
Anyway, later on he tells about a sister of this Claudius the Fair, who the chickens overboard. He says this. She was riding through the crowded streets in a carriage and making such slow progress because of the streets that she shouted, if only my brother were alive to lose another fleet. That would thin out the population a little. My brother were here to take a bunch of these people out and kill. And so that made everybody so mad they tried her in court and found her guilty of treason. And no one wants you to. She said she became the first woman ever tried for treason in Rome because of this comment, which my brother were here. Anyway, so he's talking about the family. This is a little bit not necessarily slanderous, but he's talking about the bad stuff, picks out of that, talks about it. However, he does tell some good things about Tiberius. Let me switch on back toward the end and give you a description of Tiberius. By the way, when he assumed the throne, he was 55 years old. He was a grizzled, dirty old man. He was. But he was a great soldier. An experienced, hard, and he was quite a scholar. Well, that's the way Tony's told about it. Tiberius was strong and heavily built and above average in height, big man. About that, above average, he was about 5'7", he was above height, about average height in those days. His shoulders and chest were broad, his body perfectly proportioned from top to toe. He was a veteran of many military campaigns. His left hand was more agile than the right, because he was left-handed, and so strong that he could poke a finger through a sound, newly plucked apple, or into the skull of a boy or a young man.
Nice.
Now, it's really interesting to say this, because Tiberius and Dali had done both. He had a handsome, fresh complexion face, though subject to occasional rashes of pimples. his back hair grow down over the nape seems to have been a family habit. That you can notice it was unusual, although the Romans did not wear long hair. He let his hair grow down over the nape of his neck, and that was unusual, and was noticed.
Tiberius's eyes were remarkably large and possessed the unusual power of seeing in the dark. When he first opened them after sleep, this phenomenon disappeared after a minute or two. That means that's probably the story he heard. In the dark, he first woke up. Yeah, I can't call it the story. His gait was a stiff stride, with the neck poked forward. He ever broke his usual stern silence to address those walking with him. He spoke with great deliberation and eloquent movements of the fingers. Augustus disliked these mannerisms and put them down to pride. Frequently assured the Senate in common that they were physical and not moral defects. See, Tiberius had been adopted by Caesar. Now when Tiberius was adopted by Caesar, Tiberius was an old man. Adoption doesn't do with age. He was adopted. So, 30, 40, 50 years old. It's a legal fiction. He lacked any deep regard for the gods. I'm kind of skipping around now. Or other religious feelings, his belief in astrology had been persuaded that the world was wholly ruled by fate. And they had the Stoicism in there, too. He was afraid of thunder and lightning. And when the storm put a laurel wreath on it around his head because this, he thought this was an enlightening proof. He was deeply devoted to Greek and Latin literature while still a young man. He was learned. He spoke Greek fluently. About the Greek of the international language, he spoke Greek fluently. And so he just sort of, I just skipped around to show you a sort of general picture of a man. Now, getting back to his reign, he says this, so Antonius is trying to answer the question, why did it, in other words, Augustus just chose, as I said, you're supposed to be born in this kind of office, but Augustus simply chose somebody, adopted him, and left him the office in his will. That's the way it was done. I didn't complete that eventually, I think. You got that? They simply choose somebody, adopt him, creating the legal fiction that this was his son, and then leave him the office in his will. And the Senate would have to recognize that. That is, the question was, it was established that Tiberius was the legal successor to Augustus if the Senate recognized the legality of Augustus' will. Got that? It was this way that it was passed on, yes.
So
then,
we're talking about his family.
Are
you talking about his own family?
His ancestors. The chickens in the sea, that was his ancestor, grandfather.
So he was related in some way to him?
Yes.
But he's not the
direct son. Yes.
it doesn't make any difference. I'm checking that. He's probably a nephew or second grandnephew. But you see, in Rome, most people were related to each other anyway. That's right. Among the aristocracy, among the senatorial family, the old patrician. Any other questions?
Suetonius was a late first century writer. He wrote about 69 AD, so he's looking guy in the period before he actually lived. But he was just an author who was a member of a higher family, he had a certain sense.
Well, he's trying to explain why Augustus would pick Tiberius. He says, I believe that Augustus weighed Tiberius' good qualities against the bad, decided the good tipped the scale. He had, after all, publicly sworn that his adoption of Tiberius was in the national interest, and often referred to him as an outstanding general and the only one capable of defending Rome against her enemies. So Suetonius suggests, he's probably right,
that Augustus realized that it would be good to have a good military man on the throne, and Tiberius was that. Well, anyway, and he quotes from this, closely quotes from the goodbye letter that Augustus writes. I'm not going to go into that. He says, after Agrippa died, there were several enemies of Tiberius who wanted somebody else to reign. What they would often try to do is to kill the heir and hide the will. And Tiberius, to make a long story, Tiberius knew about this. He knew there was a movement on to kill him and hide the will, or forge a will. And so there was a pretender to the throne called Agrippa Postumus. And Herod Agrippa, I think, was named after him, or that family. Agrippa's a Roman name. But this was not one of the Herods. Agrippa Postumus was in line. And so as soon as Augustus died, Tiberius already made his plan. He knew that he was to succeed. So before he even announced to the Senate the death of Augustus and presented his will, so what he would do, he would go to the Senate, announce the death, present the will, and they would recognize him as emperor. What he did was before he even went to the Senate, he had already translated, he had Agrippa Postumus done away with and assassinated. Solved that problem. Great finality. Think about assassinations. Anyway. And so then he convened the Senate and broke the news of Augustus' death. After reading a few words of the prepared, this is one of the great scenes in history. Here's Tiberius. You know, he's a grizzled, practical, but nothing else. And he wants to be emperor. He knows Augustus picked him. He knows he's got a lot of enemies who don't want him. A palace intrigue. So he presents himself. He's this hard, grizzled. We find out later he's a very filthy old man. He's anything but sensitive about, well, he's sensitive about something, but he's anything but reluctant to assume the throne. But he puts on this big act trying to create the impression that he's really broken up over the death of Augustus. He really doesn't want to be emperor. After reading a few words of a prepared speech, he suddenly groaned aloud and protesting the grief that robbed him of his voice, that he wished his life also to be taken. Handed the scroll to his son Drusus, who finished the task. All broken. I wish I had died with Augustus. It was really hard to do anything. Let the son finish reading the speech. Freeman then read Augustus' will aloud. All senators present who had witnessed the document, being first called upon to acknowledge their seals, witnesses of lower rank were present to do the same outside the house. They examined it and verified it. The preamble to the will ran as follows. Since fate has cruelly carried off my sons, Gaius and Lucius, Tiberius must inherit 2/3 of my property. Yet this ungracious wording strengthened the suspicion that Augustus had nominated Tiberius as a successor only for one of a better choice. He thought it was Jesse's third choice. If my sons had been alive, then I would have given them. But I said very few sons had died or many of these men.
Tiberius did not hesitate to exercise imperial power immediately by calling on the Praetorians, that's the official, to provide him with a bodyguard, which was to be emperor
that is, which was to be emperor in fact and in appearance, that is, before he actually accepted, formally accepted the office. It was what the ritual was. He would announce the death of Augustus. He would present the will, it would be examined. They would ask him to take the office. He would accept, and then he would be emperor. But even before he accepted, he realized he had a lot of enemies, and so he accepted a Praetorian bodyguard as if he were emperor, when really he wasn't. And Suetonius, and this fact was not lost on Suetonius, he points out exactly that he's emperor by accepting a Praetorian bodyguard when he acted as emperor again. Yet a long time elapsed before he assumed the title of emperor. When his friends urged him to accept it, he went through the fires of scolding him for the suggestion, saying that they did not realize what a monstrous beast the monarchy was, and kept the Senate guessing by his careful evasive answers and hesitation, even when they threw themselves at his feet, imploring him to change his mind. So they didn't want him either, but they're going through the motion. And this made some of them lose patience. And the confusion, the voice was heard shouting, "Oh, that didn't take him, believe it." If I knew who it was, it's not very sometimes I'd be into him. They come to his house and beg him to accept it. "Oh, you don't have to ask him." I wouldn't say at all, I didn't take him, believe it. Another senator openly taunted him with, "I like this. Some people are slow to do what they promise. You are slow to promise what you've already done." Who's kidding who? You know, you're saying you don't want it. No, come off it. You're so promised. Finally, with a great show of reluctance and complaints that they were forcing him to become a miserable and overworked slave, Tiberius accepted the title of emperor, but hinted that he later might resign it. His actual words were, "Until I grow so old that you may be good enough to grant me a respite." "Okay, children, I'll take the offer. I get to 255. I'm pretty old, I know this. Until I get so old that you let me go rest." I'll take it. But anyway, then he got down to business in a hurry. Yes.
What happened to the third of the stuff you didn't inherit?
I don't know what to say. What other name?
Invisible courage.
Yes, he's turned out very bad. Tiberius seemed to have started out pretty well. I'm going to get through Tiberius today, so I'm going to move pretty fast. But first of all, he was very stingy, what he was. He balanced the budget. He vetoed all bills for dedication to temples and priests to his divinity. They wanted to build temples to his emperor worship now, already full blown. And he vetoed it. He said, "You cannot worship me. He would not allow any temples to be built in his image worship." He did allow images in private homes, but not objects of worship. Very, very modest. And by the way, I think Tiberius was too much of a realist to buy the Caesar is God stuff. Maybe he just felt silly. Or he may just think this is part of his show of humility. But he would not allow them to acknowledge him as a god, which helped him, by the way. Tiberius didn't have any illusions about himself. He hated flattery. I mean, senators would come around and flatter him to get favors. He just wouldn't even let them near him. Well, we lack any things about him. He was slandered and lampooned by his enemies. He just ignored it. He showed excessive courtesy to the senators, to the house, to the body. He made a great pretense. Look the word Suetonius uses. He made a great pretense of restoring popular liberties by saying that the Senate and magistrates enjoyed their former dignities. He referred all business to them. Well, Augustus said, "You know from Augustus." He made a great show of referring business to them. Of course, everybody knew what he wanted to do. He consulted them about everything. Got along pretty well with them. And by the way, you see, he ruled for a long time. See that, 14 through 37? Now we're understanding some of the reasons why. He cut down the expense. I'm just picking a sentence here and there now. He cut down the expenses of public entertainments and try to save money there. He abolished foreign cults at Rome. Emperors did this ever so often. He abolished foreign cults at Rome, particularly the Egyptian and Jewish. What would the Egyptian be? Isis, the mystery religion. And the Jews, did not confuse. Forcing all citizens who had embraced these superstitious faiths to burn their religious vestments and other accessories. Jews of military age were removed to unhealthy regions on the pretext of drafting them into the army. Those too old were young to serve, including non-Jews who adopted similar beliefs. There's your Hellenistic Jews or your God-fearers, those who were almost Jews. They were expelled along with them. He banished all astrologers, except such as asked for his forgiveness and undertook to make no more predictions. Interesting, he believed in astrology, but they had a racket going. And he just ran them out of town. He safeguarded the country against banditry and local revolts by decreasing the distance between police posts with more police protection. And at Rome, provided the Praetorian Guards with regular barracks and a fortified camp. He beefed up the Praetorian Guards who served as policemen in Rome. And served as policemen, that's not true. Served more as of the National Guard. In Rome, in various periods, was the police in Rome were Scythians. And they were known for their cruelty. In Greece, you used Scythians. Anyway. He abolished the right of sanctuary to temples, by which, in holy places, which criminals enjoyed throughout the empire. That the criminal, the law would be after it, you go get in a temple and hire a sanctuary. Tiberius said, forget that bit, we believe in God anyway. Remember I taught you that among the high, that even though Augustus had thought about a reform or a renewal in mythological religion, that most of the aristocracy didn't buy it? Here's an example. Tiberius didn't care. Didn't believe God. The idea was if a person claimed the protection of a god, if you get him to drag you from the altar, then you would invoke the wrath of that god on you and up with that sanctuary. He said, wait on that, you go get it. And they did. Interesting. They didn't care. Interesting. Here's another one. Let me read this to you. And he punished the people of Cyzicus on the Sea of Marmara, which is a minor town, for their outrageous treatment of certain Roman citizens. Remember that Paul provoked fear in the hearts of the officials of Philippi because of what? They had mistreated their own citizens. And what was their reaction? Yeah, great fear. The whole town was in danger. Well, you see, this is the kind of thing they would remember. This is before. You see, this is, they would remember that this town had mistreated their own citizens. Provincial town, and he had punished the whole provider withdrawing freedom. What that means is that they were free. They had performed a great service back in the days of the Republic, the Mithridatic War, which I'm not talking about. They had performed a service for the Emperor, for the Republic, and they had been granted freedom. They didn't pay taxes. And he removed that, taxed them heavily, punished them. Philippi, see, was a Roman military town. And boy, they lost the favor of Rome. They were in big trouble. That's why they were so afraid when Paul said, are you sure you want to be a Roman citizen? You can. You know. Interesting thing. That's what happened to one town who did. Didn't say exactly what they did, but they had just treated their own citizens. Time's been away. Well, Tiberius, he was an old man, as we said, and he, the island of Capri is right up in here. I guess they're right there on the table. The island of Capri. You've heard the island of Capri, the song was about it. Well, that's where Tiberius lived and died. In his latter years. And what happened is, in his later years, he declined. He was getting older. He was 55 when he took the throne. Making a value judgment here, making a guess. But Tiberius, when he came to the throne, had no illusions. He was a realist. Didn't believe in the gods. He had been around. He was a grizzled soldier. And he really tried to continue the Augustan reform. And in many areas, he did. He did. For instance, he he did enhance the peace. One of the reasons, again, why Paul and Peter and John could travel in peace was because Tiberius had continued to suppress banditry. You read this. It was law and order. He did a pretty good job in this. And the empire, he kept the empire in pretty good shape and improved some things. So, in the spirit of the spirit of Augustus, Tiberius was a pretty good emperor. However, in his latter years, he began to decline. And what happens to many old people? You know, one of the great myths is that old people are nice. And that's simply not true. The most rotten people I ever met in my life were old people. Well, you know, first you get to be 65, instead of be a nice old lady. You know what I mean, son? I have a vision about it. The most vicious, ugly, hateful, obscene people I ever met. And I used to work on the freight docks. And I worked with men who cut for 45 minutes and reviewed themselves. I worked in factories. But I'll tell you, the first job I ever had, I went to Bible college in a hospital in Oregon. And absolutely the filthiest, most hateful, ugly, despicable people I ever met were old women. Now, see what happens is when a person gets old, often, when a person gets old, what they really are comes out. If they're really nice, they get nicer. But if they're really ugly, they get uglier. Part of the reason you see that in order for people to put up at the very living to get by, they have to put up the front. But when they retire, they don't have to make a living anymore. Or it gets acceptable now that they're old. Or they get too tired to fight anymore. They often just relapse into being themselves. And so, yeah, all I'm saying is what you'll find if you look around, is that old people simply become more of what they were all along. They were patient and kind, they get more patient and more kind. But they were ugly, they just get uglier. And that's what happened to Tiberius. He got old. And he put up a pretty good front. He ran a pretty tight ship until finally what he really was came through. Plus he came a lot of the corruption, the normal corruptions of high office. What did he do? Well, let me briefly go on. He became a drunk. He was a very filthy, very immoral. He was a sexual pervert. And finally, during the last year, he simply went to the island of Capri, this palace, and forgot about neglected the state, neglected business. He attended the business pretty well during his early years. He neglected business and spent his time in his lecheries and his debaucheries and his sexual perversions. He aligns himself with other dirty old men, the hard drinker. He drank wine with no water added. New Testament wine drinking is very much misunderstood. They had theologians deal with it, and they should have had historians deal with it. But anyway, he retired to Capri. I'm reading now. He made himself a private sporting house where sexual extravagances were practiced for a secret pleasure. Bevies of girls and young men whom he had collected from all over the empire as experts in unnatural practices, and known as Ventriot, who would reformed before him in groups of three to excite his waning passions. Very old. And, who was it once? I think it was Desmondes, didn't it? He didn't trust a man who got to be 68 years old and said, oh, I would now become moral. He said he felt that person's spirituality ought to progress a little faster than the deterioration of his glands. But anyway, this was true. He has waned the passion, so he would bring these people put on live sex shows, what it was. And a number of small rooms referring to the most indecent pictures and statuary obtainable. Also, certain erotic manuals from Egypt. Inmates of the establishment would know from these manuals what was expected of them. He'd train them in these sexual perversions. He furthermore devised little nooks of lechery in the woods and glades of the island, had boys and girls dressed up as pans and nymphs posted in front of caverns. And the next section is too filthy to read, so I'm going to read it. Some of the things he did. And so he became just a sexual pervert, just a dirty old man, and he forgot about the empire with the island and used his position as well. And then his many enemies They were always lurking there. His many enemies came to the front. In order to save his throne, he resorted to the terrible purges that you mentioned to keep himself in, and he began to kill people right and left under the guise of purges. He became very cruel.
That was after he completed the purges?
Yes. It was during his life later years. For instance, and what happened was, and this was, it was at these terrible treason trials. Hundreds were killed. What a purpose, the way this was done is, if anybody accused, if any citizen accused another citizen of being a traitor, then Tiberius automatically accepted the word of the accuser. The catch of this was that under Roman law, if you accuse somebody of treason, can't talk today, of treason, and they were found guilty after a trial, that you got his property, or most of it. Well, Tiberius wasn't, there was no trial. He just simply, somebody was accused, they're automatically guilty, and whoever accused them got their property. Now, a lot of people got rid of a lot of enemies and got wealthy during Tiberius. Do you remember that? He had somebody he didn't like, or had a nice farm, somebody accused him before Tiberius, and as they ended up, you got a good chunk of this property and got rid of the enemy. Special awards were voted to the informers who denounced them. And so hundreds were killed. And you had many thrown off the cliffs at Capri. For instance, that's why Tony says, not a day, however holy, passed without an execution. He even desecrated New Year's Day. Many of his men victims were accused and punished with their children. Some actually by their children. And relatives forbidden to go into mourning. Every crime became a capital one. Here's a mad old man now. Probably had a venereal disease, too. Probably had syphilis. But it affected his brain. Every crime was a death penalty. And he executed people that wrote, authors, some of the best, the cultural leaders. Everybody was endangered. Hundreds and hundreds were killed. Some of the accused, some were accused of being warned to appear in court. They were sent to go out and kill themselves. The bodies of all executed persons were flung on the stairs of mourning and dragged into the Tiber with hooks. Those are in Rome. As many as 20 a day, including women and children. Tradition forbade the strangling of virgins, so when little girls had been condemned to die in this way, the executioner began by violating them. He said, the law said that you could not strangle or hang a virgin. And so, Tiberius said, don't worry about that, just rape them, and then not a virgin anymore. Tiberius, you wonder why the gospel was such good news of a king like Jesus. They had that man thought like this. But again, this is later years. And he goes on, when his own son died, he didn't even notice. It's Drusus, the one who read the funeral speech when he announced the death of Augustus. He goes on, and finally, let me read his death, and there's no time to be gone. I don't have any time for more, but did you get the picture? There's a man who really, well, he was all along, he just got worse, when he was dead, nobody was sorry. Yes.
Was it at this time the gospel was starting to spread? Is that what the time?
No. This is the kind of thing that was going on. Jesus was preaching during these years. By the way, y'all hear that? This is he died in 37. So this is what's going on in Rome while Jesus is carrying on his public ministry.
Did he have an adopted son?
Yes. We're talking about Caligula. Let me tell you about his death, okay? Give me another minute. Some believe that he was poisoned. But he began to die. Although on his last birthday, Tiberius dreamed that an enormous, beautiful statue of Apollo, which had been brought from Temenus, a suburb of Syracuse, directed the library of Augustus Temple, came in to announce, Tiberius will never dedicate me, because he's going to die before this occurs. A few days before his death, the Capri lighthouse was wrecked by an earthquake. At Misenum, the dead embers of a fire which had been put into a brazier to warm his dining room suddenly blazed up again, burning and continued to glow as it fell off on the stream side. And then he died. The first news of his death, the people ran to Rome, play on words, to the Tiber with Tiberius. What do they mean? State funeral,
Oh, I'm in the river.
I gave him a joke to the congregation.
So, the death of the man who was ruling the ministry of Jesus.